Hi, it's good to have your company. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. My name's Simon Smart. I have a special guest today, Dr. Barbara Ferguson. She's in from recent trips to the Congo and building on a life that's been really working many decades, really, with people who've had their lives turned upside down by war and other trauma. Barbara's been an academic. She's worked at the University of New South Wales for a long time, teaching in the School of Social Work. She's also been a counsellor in the Pacific Islands, Southeast Asia. She's a recipient of the Order of Australia Medal. I don't think we've had someone like that before, Barbara, and this was for development programs, working with migrants, refugees, and overseas students. In recent years, she's been making trips to the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. We've talked a bit about the Congo before on this program. Barbara became especially involved with a group of pygmy people, people who've been displaced from their forest homes and systematically denied human rights. We want to talk to her about that today. Barbara supported efforts with this group to establish a village and working with those people to improve their quality of life and educate their children. Barbara, great to have you in.
Thank you, Simon. It's my pleasure.
Now, I believe you worked in South Vietnam as a young woman, and now you make regular trips, as we mentioned, to the Congo. I wanted to first ask you how you got interested in this sort of work that's taking you to quite dangerous places.
Oh, my goodness, that goes back to my childhood and a camp for children in Kayama when I heard someone talking about Livingstone and his travels in Africa. And I was a very lonely child. I'd lost my twin brother. And I remember on the Sunday night, the person who was speaking in the church, which we all attended for that camp, talking about how Livingstone thought that if he served Christ, he'd never be alone. And I thought, oh, that's what I need to do. I don't ever want to be alone again, so I'll serve Christ.
That's a very formative moment, I guess, as a young girl. And then that took you, I guess, led you on a path that eventually took you to places like the Pacific and Vietnam.
Yes, well, initially to Vietnam. And I was there for 8 years throughout the war. And I regarded it as my second homeland, and I still have very close ties with the Vietnamese community here.
How did you find yourself working in South Vietnam, especially during the war? A lot of people were trying to get out of there, and you went willingly.
Well, I guess it was following on from that childhood idea that I should serve Christ wherever I was called. And at that time, I thought I'd go to Africa when I was 8 years old. But I did 3 years at Deaconess House and studied at Moore College. And at that time, the Vietnam War was on our television sets all the time. And I thought, I saw an article in the Sydney Morning Herald where the Australian Council of Churches was looking for teachers to go to work in South Vietnam in refugee camps. And I thought, that's it.
So that's what you did. You went to work as a teacher. Is there a sense then, this was a passionate thing for you? It wasn't that you were dragging your feet as you went there.
No. It was, I suppose even now looking back, I took all sorts of risks because I thought I was invulnerable. And as a young woman, I had experiences that, I just thought were wonderful. I liked the adventure. And also the sense of meaning in life. You know, I have no trouble getting up every morning despite now at 72 there's lots of aches and pains, but my goodness, I've got a lot of work to do and it's just such a wonderful motivation.
You must have seen some amazing and challenging things during that period of your life in South Vietnam.
Yes, I did. And our group were at one stage under fire in an American camp. But, Vietnam was easy compared to Africa.
Yeah, let's talk about Africa because you've spent some time now, a number of trips to the Congo. This is a very, very difficult place. We hear terrible stories out of the Congo. Give us just a broad picture of what life is like there.
Well, first of all, just as an Australian getting in, sometimes people say to me, I'd love to come with you. It sounds so interesting and exciting and so on. But, it's just not easy to get in there to begin with because we don't have diplomatic missions there and they don't have here. So even just getting across the border, mostly it's a 3-day journey to get there. and coming in by road from Rwanda. And you never know what's going to happen at the border. The city where I'm based when I'm there is called Goma. And it's a city of a million people, but there's no regular water or electricity supply. There's no public services in that area. People are burning their rubbish by the road. The police, the teachers, the public servants aren't paid regularly, so there's a lot of corruption. Many of the main roads in this city of a million people aren't sealed. And also Goma is in the shadow of three active volcanoes, so you have a lot of grit and fumes and so on. So it's not an easy place to live.
There's been a civil war going on for a long time, and there's been a terrible human cost with that. I've heard it's been described as the worst place on earth to be a woman.
Yes, well, some people have called it the rape capital of the world. To some extent, the emphasis on the rape of women has not been a good thing for the women of Congo. All of the aid is premised on, you know, we're going to help these women first. And it's drawn attention to it. And I even heard that one of the rebel generals said, we have to rape the women because that will give us a seat at negotiating tables. So, you know, it's very difficult because it is happening. And my initial work there as a volunteer at the Hill Africa Hospital in 2009 was training counsellors to work with the rape torture survivor. And women are mutilated and, in their words, destroyed, not only physically but also socially, because even their husbands may feel that they want to throw them out.
There's a stigma attached to this.
There's a stigma attached to it, and for a young woman it means very likely that she won't be able to marry. But I have a wonderful story I'd like to tell you about a young rape survivor, a pygmy woman. I hadn't met her. I've just come back from my fifth trip to the Democratic Republic of Congo and working with a group of pygmy people in a village which is about 30 kilometres out of the city of Goma. And this last trip, I just arrived back in the village and this woman came up to me and I hadn't met her before. And what amazed me was that she said hello to me in English because English isn't spoken there. And I found out that she had been raped a couple of years ago. She'd been sent to Heal Africa for treatment. But someone had recognised that she was very bright. Now, most of the pygmies are illiterate. They had recognised that she was able to do some further study. And they sent her, and she has a certificate in teaching literacy. She has a certificate in community development. She has a certificate in English. She has a certificate in community studies. And she'd been sent back to this village, which would not have existed in if she'd come back before 2010 when we built the village and bought the land. And she would have been living in the mud on a grass humpy with no way of earning any. But she was already, having come back to the village, working with a group of children that we had been paying teachers to help. And so I hired her on the spot. Aid programs have to do more than just fix one problem. Approaches to helping people have to be holistic. It's no good training people to do something and not following up and seeing that they have some way of using those skills.
You mentioned the pygmy people. You've had a lot of work with these people. Establishing, well, they're in a very vulnerable position to begin with. I hear that broadly they weren't considered fully human, and that your work there has tried just to recognise their humanity and give them some dignity despite some of the ways they've been treated.
Yes, well, that's true. And the majority group, the Bantu group, the various tribes there, do not consider them fully human because they have lived such a different lifestyle in the forests, although they lived sustainably. And if you read some of the anthropological work about their lifestyle, it's actually very beautiful and how they regarded the forest as their father who looked after them. And them being displaced from the forest, however, has destroyed so much of their culture and their skills. And this group of people I met in 2010, my second visit to Congo, I'd gone out of the hospital, and as I said, I worked for 8 years in South Vietnam. I thought I'd seen every, you know, misery that a refugee camp could hold for you. But if you were a pygmy, you were at the bottom of the line. If any aid was being handed out, it didn't come down the line to the pygmies. And, you know, they were just a remarkable group of people, nevertheless, despite what I was being told about them, that they, you can't help them, Barbara, because they're unreliable, they're ungrateful, they really don't know how to use any help you might. And I actually made friends with a couple of the women, and I said to them, let's have a meeting, and what would you like? What can I do? I make a solemn promise to you and to myself that I'm going to help you. And they said, our children, look at our children. If our children don't have some education, they have no future. They will be like us, the men having to hire themselves out like beasts of burden to carry people's goods if they're going to earn anything. And the women going back to the forest where they were so often raped and even kidnapped by the various militias. There were about 20 militia groups marauding around the area. So that was what I did first of all with the money that I was saving up for a new car. And since then, I've raised about $70,000 from friends and family and speaking at various places. And all the children are in school, and these little grass huts that they were not even really huts, they're like little igloos that they were living in, didn't protect them from the weather. So when the children started at school, we also had to have uniforms and books and bags and shoes, and the rain would just come through and ruin their books.
You established housing for them, simple housing, didn't you,
well,
or your group?
It was more a case of once we'd bought land for them, and they chose the land, which turned out to be very clever of them. They chose land in a very safe place. Once they had land, then there was a local group of the Seventh-day Adventist Church who had money from the Danish government to build houses or to provide materials to build houses. Not houses as we would think of them, but houses that are made out of sticks and clay and cement and tin roofs. And once they had land, then I was able to talk to that group of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and they brought in the materials. But the minute the materials were brought in, the pygmies, men and women, all got involved, and they built the houses themselves. They built the houses, they know how to repair them. Their sense of self-esteem and accomplishment is so, you know, raised up by doing that.
They get a real sense of this is what we've done, and we're proud of it, and we'll look after it, and it contributes to the whole,
it's
the whole
village.
Uplifting picture of the village. Mm. Now, you mentioned earlier in the conversation that you're motivated, you were as an eight-year-old and still are, by this sense of a calling, of God's calling on your life, really, to work with in these sorts of situations. They're pretty grim situations in lots of ways, but do you see God working?
I do indeed. As I mentioned, there's these women that I've come to know quite well, and there's one, her name's Nyota, which means star in Swahili, and when her house was finished, she painted a big star on the front. And some of the other women have, you know, like there's a woman called Rose, and she's put painted a rose on the front of her house. Now, when I went back this last trip, I went straight to Nyota and some of the others, the women, I went straight to where their houses are. There's 60 plus houses now in the village. And I was surprised to see outside the front of the house a soldier's wife, obviously a soldier's wife, she was Bantu, not pygmy, washing soldiers' clothes. And then I looked along the line and I saw that there were other soldiers' clothes laid out to dry, and I thought, oh no, this is exactly what I was told would happen. The soldiers come in, they'll take over. The pygmies have no rights, even though they've got the deeds to the land. And I just said to the woman, Wapi Nyota, where's Nyota? And she said, Anatoka, gone away. And I ran to the man who works with me as an interpreter, and I said, we've got to find the women. I think they've been forced out of the houses. So we gathered them together, and I said, you don't have to put up with this. It's your land, they're your houses, I'll get our lawyer, you know, to put an end to this. And they said, no, you don't understand. we know what it's like to live like animals. We saw the soldiers' families who have to follow their men, and they're living in holes in the ground with a bit of plastic over the top. We have these beautiful houses now. How could we see our neighbours living like this? We invited them to share with us.
Amazing work. Great privilege to hear about it. And thanks so much for telling your story for us today.
Thanks for the opportunity.